Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com. At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
Welcome to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm Matthew of castingacross.com, where I explore the quarry and culture of fly fishing. Today we're going to talk about that quarry, which happens to be trout, and the culture, which happens to be us as anglers and conservationists that are so interested in them. One kind of trout in particular that's going to start our conversation, it's something that has been in the news a lot lately, and that is the greenback cutthroat trout. The greenback cutthroat. But before we get into that, I wanted to take a step back and talk about why we care about fish species. Why do we care about fish species? Why is so much made of the difference between rainbow trout and cutthroat trout, of brown trout and brook trout? Why does it matter? If you are new to this, if you are just getting into fly fishing, or if you've been fly fishing for a long time and you really don't see the big deal, which there's people that are like this, and so I don't want you to feel like I'm talking down to anyone. I also don't want you to feel like I am talking about something that's ridiculous. I'd also want you to think about the fact that I am talking about something that is not worth having the conversation about, because I've talked to people who have the opinion that it really doesn't matter what kind of fish you're catching as long as you're catching a fish, and that a lot of time, energy, and effort is wasted in talking about fish species. And I've also just talked to people who are a little bit ignorant, or naive would probably be a better word, regarding the differences of fish. And then, of course, there's a wide swath of people in fly fishing who are incredibly pedantic about species of trout. I find myself somewhere in the middle, but I probably err towards the side that really appreciates the differences in fish species. So why is this a big deal? Well, it's a big deal as an angler because you need to know what you're catching, because the regulations dictate what you can and can't catch, what you can and can't keep. But beyond that, we have an opportunity as anglers, as people who use the outdoors, to be stewards of the natural environment that we are spending our time in, particularly the resources of water and the fish therein. And so if we are taking care of that, it is going to last longer. And that's just a basic reality of using resources. But of course, we find ourselves here in the 21st century after a couple of centuries, a few hundred years of mismanagement. Some of that was accidental. Some of that was just not understanding that some of the damming of rivers, the diversion of waterways, and the utilization of water for agricultural and industrial use was going to be as damaging as it was. I don't put nefarious intentions on the hearts of everyone who built a water wheel, or who built up a diversion dam, or built their factory next to water. Certainly some did, well, knowing full well what they were getting into, but I'm not going to say that of everybody. But secondly, there is also overfishing, and people caught way too many brook trout in the Catskills. People caught way too many fish in the Rocky Mountains, and then decided, you know what, these fish are getting low, so let's supplement them with more fish. And those fish interbred with those first fish, and now you've lost a unique population. And so this has gotten us to the situation that we've really been in for about 100 years. You can really see from a large scale movement perspective, people caring about this in the late first half of the 20th century. Certainly there was people who were standing on the wall yelling that there's problems about this before that. You can even go back 100 years before that. But as a nation and as a movement, when you see a lot of conservation organizations getting involved, particularly cold water conservation, we're talking to the late mid part of the 20th century. And a great example of that is the greenback cutthroat. So just this last week on the news, lots of different news sources, and I wrote about this on castingacross.com, a story came out about how greenback cutthroat are successfully reproducing unaided by human help from the Colorado Parks and Wildlife, I think is what the CPW is, that they're reproducing unaided in a new stream. Well, what does that mean? Well, a brief history of the greenback cutthroat, and I'm certainly not an expert, and you can hop online and read all sorts of stuff about the greenback cutthroat. But the greenback cutthroat is a particular strain of the cutthroat trout. And so it is, there's only cutthroat trout. However, the populations, because of isolation and because of limitations in their breeding, because of their special habitats that they live in, they develop certain traits that establish them as strains or subspecies of cutthroat trout. The same is true of brook trout, the same is true to a much lesser degree, but the same is true of brown trout, the same is true of rainbow trout. You see this in all sorts of other fish and all sorts of other animals. But of course, trout which are fish are limited to the water. And because trout have a smaller margin for existence than maybe some other species, you see them forming lots of different substrains and populations because they are not just limited to water, but they're limited to certain parts of water. So they are able to form these strains and those subspecies over time. Now, the greenback cutthroat was understood as a unique subspecies all the way back in the middle to late 19th century. So I'm using very vague terms here because I don't have notes or anything like that in front of me. And when the 20th century rolls around, the greenback cutthroat was considered extinct. This was something where it was acknowledged to be in the South Platte, maybe in the Arkansas, but by the time you get to the early part of the 20th century, between population degradation from, again, the aforementioned issues of agriculture and overfishing, but then also from the introduction of more species, especially rainbow trout, which are close enough in relation, genetically speaking, to cutthroat trout, where they're able to interbreed, create what is commonly known as a cutbow. The greenback cutthroat were considered to be extinct for all intents and purposes. One quick note, I didn't mention this when it comes to strains and subspecies. Something that is certainly not within my wheelhouse of expertise, but I've read a little bit about, is the ability to use genetic testing to determine things at this strain or subspecies level. And the more advancements we make, the further we can dive down into the genetics of these fish and determine how closely two samples of any given fish are related to one another. And this is where you're not having to use the eye test, where you say, well, this one's got a few more black spots than that one. This one might have a longer red slash than the other one. So I think these belong in this strain versus that strain. Because as any of us who's fish in any body of water knows, is that even within one body of water, any two fish may have a little bit different coloration. And so to be able to use genetic technology that is just, you know, rapidly getting better, we're able to know more today than we did yesterday, and certainly more than they did when they were having to just look at things under a normal microscope. So coming back to the middle part of the 20th century, a population was assumed to be discovered, and this is, I think, in the 1950s, in Rocky Mountain National Park. So you have the Big Thompson River, which is a tributary of the South Platte. And I've talked about the Big Thompson. I've talked about Estes Park. I've talked about Rocky Mountain National Park on podcasts before. It's where I caught my very first Rocky Mountain fish, my very first fish, probably west of the Mississippi, to be exact. And I saw cutthroat trout, and being a member of Trout Unlimited since I was a teenager, I knew all about all of these initiatives about reestablishing cutthroat trout, especially the greenback cutthroat, in their native range. And so I got super pumped, and I actually spent a number of trips going up into the mountains and catching these fish that I assumed were greenback cutthroats. Well, what happens? you get to the later part of the 20th century, and the 21st century, in the, I think, 2012, 2010, something like that, they determined that these fish were not the actual greenback cutthroats. These were probably like Colorado cutthroat or a Rio Grande cutthroat, which are other subspecies. And again, the problem was is that if you look at these two fish, they look virtually identical because you have variation within each species. However, a population of greenback cutthroat that didn't just pass the eye test, didn't just pass the historical range test, but also passed genetic test, was found in a little tributary of the Arkansas River called Bear Creek. So to talk about that history again, we're talking about fish that existed and thrived, were considered extinct, were quote-unquote rediscovered, and then after further evaluation, that rediscovery went from a relatively wide range to a very, very small range. In fact, only one creek, this Bear Creek, a tributary of the Arkansas River. But from those fish, they have since been reintroduced to a couple other streams that would have been in the greenback cutthroat's native range. And as of this week, news came out saying that these populations are now naturally reproducing. So that's kind of the width and breadth of what's going on with the greenback cutthroat. Why does this matter? How does this help your fishing, or how does this impact your fishing? Well, I would say there's a few things. First of all, optimism. Have optimism. This is awesome. It's a great story. There's so much awful stuff going on in the world. You know, you get on regular Twitter and it's just a disaster. You get onto fly fishing Twitter and there's always something that somebody's whining about. And there oftentimes there are legitimate things to be kind of upset about. But this doom scrolling, this just everything is awful. It's not true, first and foremost. Secondly, here's an example of something very good happening. This is not saying that we're back to where things were pre-colonization or pre-impact from man, which, I mean, I don't even know where your baseline is for what we're trying to return to. But you're seeing positive steps being done with cooperation between a number of bureaucratic and also volunteer groups to do good work. So have some optimism. Look at this as a good story, some good news, right? Secondly, this ought to make you appreciate the diversity and the discovery that we can have as we look at fly fishing. So one of the things that I really enjoy is trying to find weird little populations of brook trout. I've talked about this before on the website, where I just really enjoy trying to find tiny streams as close to me as possible or in close to places where I live and work and play, where I'm finding small populations of brook trout. I know plenty of places where I can go and catch consistent 14 and 16-inch stocked fish. And that's fine. And I'm not as good as I could be. I'm certainly not the best at catching these fish. And that's fun. And I enjoy that. I'm never going to turn my nose up at catching a 16-inch rainbow here on the East Coast. At the same time, there's something especially exciting to me about finding those 4 and 6 inch brook trout on a stream that doesn't make the regulations book, that it doesn't have special pull-offs for anglers. Those are the creeks that get me excited because there's an element of discovery. And then to look at that fish and the pictures I take of these little pretty fish in the water and compare them to fish that are caught maybe on the other side of a watershed or the next watershed over and see the differences and the similarities, especially if I can look back in some of the records and realize that there's a very good chance that these are not fish that have been stocked or fish that have been stocked over. So as messed up as the East Coast is, where I am, you know, northern Massachusetts and New Hampshire and southern Maine, that there's still remnant populations. And for me, that's exciting. That might not make you excited, but it's like taking blue lining to the next level. And that sense of exploration and then seeing the diversity, it's very cool. Now, we don't have, again, that real distinct strain and subspecies kind of thing here on the East Coast, especially within a relatively small area like New England, for example. But you get out west and you get to some of these states that have a wide variety of strains of cutthroat trout or rainbow trout, and you begin to see that there is a great opportunity for exploration. There's a great opportunity for seeking out the diversity and coming to appreciate how every ecosystem, every landscape has a little bit of a different bearing on these strains of these fish, which again, genetically essentially the same with a few different markers. So a good example of that is in the state of Utah. With the Utah has something called the cutthroat slam, and other states have this as well. With Utah, you try to catch all of the native cutthroat trout, which there's the Bonneville, the Colorado, Yellowstone, Bear River, maybe one more, but I think that's it. And I guess that's because a grand slam is four, right? You know, Wyoming has a similar thing, and their fish are going to be the Bear River, their Colorado River, Snake River, and the Yellowstone cutthroat. And, you know, when you get on these websites and you get on books, they're going to find great examples of like what a perfect picture of an exemplary fish in this strain or this subspecies looks like. But you look at enough pictures online, you realize there is a lot of crossover. But still, it's exciting. It's really fun. Somebody that I had the privilege of talking to countless times and also sitting under his teaching was Dr. Robert Behnke, who, as most people acknowledge, is the late Robert Behnke was the foremost salmonid expert in probably the world. And this was one of his passions, was seeing the differences of these subspecies and these strains, and also the fact that we have preserved so many of them, that they have been preserved, that you can still go and see and catch and touch these fish, that they are not something that has been relegated to a museum or something like that. Now, there are plenty of fish that are in that category. The yellowfin cutthroat, for example. The yellowfin cutthroat existed primarily in the Twin Lakes region of Colorado, but by the early 20th century, there had been rainbow trout that were introduced, and they not only edged out the yellowfin and effectively had made them extinct, but also they have interbred with the greenback cutthroat in that Twin Lakes region, which was also a part of the Arkansas River drainage. And so this one introduction of one fish, you know, the fish that they're trying to conserve and preserve on the western side of the Rocky Mountains is doing all sorts of damage on the east side of the Rocky Mountains. But that just gives you an example of one species of trout that we don't think we're getting back. Now, could they clone it? Yeah, absolutely, they could do that. But it's not the same as finding a remnant species high up on a mountainside. Now, does this mean that we go to Bear Creek and this other new creek that they have discovered that these fish are spawning in and go and try to catch them all so we can get pictures of them? It depends. It really does depend. I do not feel like we need to be dogmatic about accessing and utilizing these resources, because we, sportsmen and women, are honestly going to be the greatest advocates for the preservation of these fish. Fish that might have a subspecies or strain status where they might not as easily as a fish that is a completely unique species make it onto some sort of conservation list. So we are going to you know, see the benefits and see the unique nature of these strains. And so by becoming familiar with these fish and having a relationship with their water bodies and the areas around them, we're going to be their best advocates. And sometimes that means, you know, if you love something, you know, set it free. Just let it go do its thing and know that it's there. Sometimes it means utilizing that resource and being there and just being responsible and demonstrating that there is more going on here than some sort of arbitrary designation about a substrain of a fish. That this is something that is a draw, that is something that people value, and they're willing to spend time, energy, effort, and resources in making sure that it stays a thing, and then that those fish propagate and are able to last. I mean, there's plenty of streams here where I've caught one brook trout in it, and I said, you know what? Based on the size of this fish and the size of this stream, I am content to say that I have done what I wanted to do and here, and I'm going to let it be. And that doesn't make me virtuous or super righteous. It's just the way that I look at some of these streams where I'm catching a 4-inch trout, and I'm thinking, how many other 4-inch trout are there here? I think I'm probably content to just see this one and know that they live there. And the exploration and the hunt was as fun as, well, you know, not a whole lot of fun to catch the 4-inch fish from a fight standpoint. It's more of the getting there and knowing it's there that that I appreciate. So wherever you live, this is something that you can engage in. I wrote an article about the sunapee trout a few months ago, and I think I called it The Trout You'll Never Catch. And it's because the last remaining known population of these fish is in a water body that is barred from people accessing it. So we know those fish are there, but we can't touch them. I mean, certainly the main wardens can go touch them and things like that, and we know that they're in there, but it's a little bit different. And so it's one of those things too, where how much resources and how much manpower and how much federal funding or state funding do we want to spend on reintroducing a fish into a water body? That's where you see something like what's happening in Colorado is so special. It was very organic. It was very natural, and there's a lot of steam that was able to make this happen. But these are things that are fun to pay attention to. Again, it's fun to have that optimism, to know that we can do these things. But it's also fun to know the history. The history is so that we don't repeat it and get into the same mistakes, but also to understand that there's something special about the fish that you catch if you live on the East Coast in Maine. That's different than the fish that you catch in Georgia. I really treasure some of these South Carolina brook trout that I caught. And it doesn't mean that the Spring Creek, Pennsylvania brook trout I caught were any less special. They're just very different from one another. And they're the same fish, but they're different fish. Very different lives, very different histories. And understanding that is a great way to really appreciate catching a fish at a deeper level. So if you're all about just catching trout, then I can appreciate that. But know that there's more there. If you are pedantic about it, then try to share in an articulate and in a compassionate and gracious way why there is more to catching fish than just catching fish to your friends and to those you encounter on the stream. And it's not just about abiding by the regulations. It's about understanding the deeper, richer experience that comes from understanding our resources. This week's articles, Monday, was Trout and Feather, September 22, and I write about building your analog angling library. So every month or so, I contribute to Tim Camisa's website, Trout and Feather, with an article, and I share some of his resources on my website. And this month, I talked about building up your angling library. Tim has a relatively new book out. I think it came out in actually late 21, and it's a fly tying book. It's a great book. I would absolutely recommend it if you are a new fly tier or if you are getting somebody into fly tying. There's some recipes that anybody could benefit from, but the photography and the technique is something that we could even put in the hands of a beginner. So I absolutely recommend Tim's book. I have another recommendation at the end of the podcast, but I wanted to throw that in there. But you can read about building a library, something I've talked about quite a bit on Casting Across, but this is a nice distilled article over at Trout and Feather. And then Wednesday's article is called Greenbacks Are Back, Trout in the News. And guess what I talked about? Talked about exactly what I just talked about for the last 21 minutes. But here I included some links to some non-fly fishing articles. So we've been hearing about greenback cutthroat trout for decades and decades in fly fishing media. Here you have local TV affiliates and Colorado Public Radio talking about greenback cutthroat. And for me, it's always interesting to hear what kind of mainstream media has to say about fly fishing and the kind of things that us fly fishers pay attention to. So check out that article and click on some of those links. This week's recommendation, and I have a lot to say about this, but I'm going to keep it short. Get yourself a Garmin watch. I got one for my birthday, and it is not the lowest model because I don't want a lot of bells and whistles, but it is like the next one up. I think it's called the Forerunner 245. So it's still a pretty fancy watch in the grand scheme of things, but I mean, the higher end models go up to like $900. Definitely didn't want to wear that on my wrist. But this one is a lot of fun for a lot of reasons. I run. I don't talk about that much, but I run a lot. And so this is a way for me to add some empirical data to just getting out and exercising. And it doesn't take up a lot of time. It's not very complicated, but it helps me keep track of things, make sure that I'm being efficient in the way that I exercise. But there's also a way to track how much trail time you spend. There's a way to track just for like nerd things, like know how long you've walked on the stream, the altitude that you've gained, your stride length, things like that might have zero interest to you, or it might be something that, like me, you're like, oh, that's kind of interesting to know. But then also there's a map function, which for me is great if you are kind of bushwhacking a little bit and you have zero cell phone service. To be able to get a little bit of GPS help from something on your wrist is very, very cool. And it also, bare minimum, you can tell you how long you've walked. And so if you know how much time you have to get back, which for me, fishing up in some of the national forests around here, there's not a lot of cell phone service coverage. So it is kind of a fun thing to have, but it also can be a very helpful thing. Getting to duck season, and it gives me my sunrise. So all I got to do is subtract half an hour, and I know when I can shoot legally. I don't really care about steps or heart rate or anything like that, but also tells me the temperature. It's just a fun little tool that you can use for as serious of purposes or as casual purposes as you want. So I will put a link to the Garmin Forerunner 245. I think mine is the Music, although I don't plan on listening to music on my watch anytime soon. But I'll put a link to that on the show notes for this podcast page on castingacross.com. Thanks for listening to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. Please subscribe to your favorite podcast app and rate the podcast in iTunes. Then head over to castingacross.com for 3 posts a week on the people, places, and things that go into the pursuit of fish.